I'm Austin Meek with Waco Business News, and you're listening to Downtown Depot, where we track the ins and outs of Waco business. My guest today is Haley Stewart. Haley's a Catholic author, podcaster, and speaker. We talk about Catholic Christmas, Catholic Twitter, and how she adapted the philosophies of Jane Austen for her new book coming out in March. Haley, welcome to Downtown Depot.
Thanks so much for having me.
I am so excited to have you, particularly here in this Christmas season. We're going to talk about some of your Catholic writings and your Catholic faith. But first, I want people to contextualize you and your place here in Waco. So tell us a little bit about your life.
Sure. So I grew up in Florida, but then came out to Baylor for school. And then my husband, my high school sweetheart, he followed me out to Baylor. And we had our first kid in Waco, and then we moved back to Florida for a little bit, but then Waco drew us back in. So we moved back about 7 years ago, worked on the World Hunger Relief Farm just north of Waco, and now my husband works at Balcones Distilling, and we've got four kids now, and I'm a writer and a podcaster, and yeah, we love Waco.
For listeners who aren't familiar with the work of the relief farm, it's up in Elmont, I think. It's kind of north of us. What is the story there? What's their mission? And what exactly were Daniel and you doing?
Sure. So I think that they've had some changes since we were working out there. But when we moved out there, it's a faith-based agricultural training farm. So focused on world hunger issues and things like that. So when we moved out there, we actually sold our house in Florida and got rid of most of our stuff. We had three kids at the time. And we moved out there into a 650-square-foot apartment with no flushing toilets because they're a no-flush farm. They're very environmentally conscious. And my husband was doing a livestock internship out there. So he was working with the goats and the cows and chickens. And we lived there for a year in community. And it was a great, crazy experience.
What was one of the main learnings that you had looking back on it?
I think one of the main things we learned is that while we decided not to go into farming after that year, we really grew to appreciate the time we had together as a family because we were living the same place that he was working and we were interning. And so we really tried to carry that into our life off the farm, is just having this really family home-centered life in the middle of all the other projects we were doing. And then also just the experience of living in community is always challenging because people are messy and, you know, it's difficult. Relationships are difficult, but also just really seeing the fruit of that and the benefits of doing that hard thing, the beautiful things that come out of living in community. That was a really awesome thing as well.
Is that where y'all were introduced to beekeeping?
Actually, my husband did some beekeeping, or he was interested in beekeeping before that, but I guess that's where he got really into it. So, yeah.
What does into it mean? Like, help me understand, because you guys are currently, do you have bees at your house?
We don't have them at our house because I got nervous because we have small children who would have no concept of do we or do we not throw a ball right next to the beehive and, you know, get the bees all riled up. So they're actually at a friend's house. And at this point, I think he lost a couple hives this past year. So I think there's just one or two hives that are still hanging in there. I think the one he's got was a swarm in a friend's trash can. They discovered this hive, this swarm of bees, and he came out and scooped the bees, took them away, and set up this hive. And trash can is what we call the hive, and it's the hardiest and the strongest hive he's got.
Well, in addition to homesteading and beekeeping, you have found the time and energy to write. And you're actually quite prolific. You have your podcast, the Fountains of Carrots podcast, but you've also contributed to a number of magazines and publications, the University of Notre Dame's Church Life Journal, Public Discourse, America Magazine to be one. How did you get into the literary space and the journalistic space? Is that something you had studied in college? Or have you always been a writer, you know, before the kids wake up and after the kids go to sleep?
Yeah, well, it's kind of interesting because I did the University Scholars Program in the Honors College at Baylor, which was fantastic, but I never really thought of myself as a writer. That wasn't one of my aspirations. And then after I became a mom, I think that was just, there was like this burst of creativity where I just needed this creative outlet to kind of process this big transformation in my life. And so I started writing about motherhood and writing about my Catholic faith because we had recently converted to Catholicism. And then it just kind of became the creative spark that was something that in the middle of all of the craziness of, you know, having four kids and being busy as a parent, having this creative space to write was really life-giving, and just I got so much energy from that creative work.
When you begin writing, is it, I'm Haley, I'm journaling, maybe someone's going to read this and find it helpful, or do you go into it with an audience intentionally in mind?
Yeah, I go with an audience in mind. So writing for different publications, different kinds of projects. I wrote a blog for a really long time that's now completely neglected. But when I was writing that, I was kind of writing to other young moms or, you know, young women in my stage of life who also really liked to read and liked literature, but maybe were also busy with kids and kind of balancing out all of these passions. And then when I write for different publications, I think about, you know, what their audience is and how to kind of tailor my writing to fit that audience.
You alluded to your conversion to Catholicism. Was that from being irreligious to being Catholic, or had you been sort of a more traditional Protestant and moved into Catholicism?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I grew up kind of just mainline Protestant. So from my family's faith was really important to them. So I grew up in the church, grew up really having faith as the center of our family life. And then as I got older and was looking for a home church of my own in Waco, and at the same time I was reading a lot of the writings of the early church fathers, reading a lot of Catholic novelists, and just being really both drawn to the church, the church's beauty and tradition, but then also finding out that I had a lot of misconceptions about the Catholic Church. And so reading the early church fathers, reading what the church actually taught, not just what I thought they taught, because I was wrong about so many things, that kind of broke down a lot of the intellectual barriers I had as a Protestant growing up in the Bible Belt. You know, I grew up in North Florida, believed a lot of weird things about what Catholics believed that weren't actually true. And so then it was just kind of a journey from there, having both being attracted to the beauty of the church and then coming to believe in the truth of the church was kind of how my spiritual journey went.
There is something that's so attractive about Catholicism in knowing that all across the world, the same type of service is being performed at every single parish, I guess. But like, okay, everyone is taking the Eucharist at this time. We're doing it really communally. In the Protestant world, it seems to be much more fragmented and, okay, we do baptism once a month, or we do it quarterly, or we do it every single Sunday. The Catholic Church seems like it's truly universal in a way that a lot of these other denominations might not be.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's one of the things that really attracted me to the Catholic Church. I recently got to go to a trip in France this fall, which was amazing. And it was just so cool going to these churches across the world, whether they were masses in English or masses in French, being able to follow along because I know what's happening regardless of the language. There's this shared common liturgy. And it was a really incredible experience, especially being in churches that were 800 years old sometimes and thinking about every Sunday for the past 800 years, people have been sitting here and we've been sharing this liturgy and receiving the Eucharist together despite the differences in time and geography, that in any church anywhere in the world, I'm connected to every other Catholic in the world is kind of mind-blowing.
And a way that that really crystallizes is when you have corporate worship. So everyone comes together at the church and we know that we're taking the Eucharist, similarly to how people all across the world are. During COVID, there was no opportunity for this corporate type of worship. Everything was virtual. How did your conception of community and corporate worship change because of COVID?
Yeah, that's a great question. That was a really tough time for Catholics because we believe that receiving the sacrament of the Eucharist, which in some other denominations might be called the Lord's Supper or Communion, we call it the Eucharist, you know, we believe that something really grace-filled and real happens when you receive that sacrament, that you're really receiving Jesus. And so not to be able to physically receive for, you know, week after week for a while when churches had to be closed, that was really, really challenging for Catholics. But we did live stream Mass for a while on Sunday mornings, which is just feels so weird, but also was really comforting, at least to just be able to follow along with the liturgy, that the priest is celebrating Mass and we can participate on a spiritual level, even though we can't physically be together. That first Easter of COVID, where we couldn't be at church, that was really weird. But then also such a blessing to be able to be together again, to be worshiping together physically, has been really good.
I noticed during COVID, and maybe it was just what the algorithm was sending me, but an uptick of Catholic Twitter on my own Twitter feed. And that's actually how I first interacted with you. I saw you writing stuff. It was all very family-oriented, which I am too. And it seemed like the Catholic community in particular took COVID as an opportunity to come together on Twitter and to, you know, share their experiences, send out requests for prayer. Talk a little bit about Catholic Twitter, because Cat Twitter is its own sort of weird cesspool in and of itself. But you're quite active there. I mean, you have thousands of followers, people who are looking at your tweets and want to know about what you're writing and thinking about parenting and faith. Just that's an open-ended question, but like take this where you want to.
Sure. I mean, Catholic Twitter, like any online community, and to back up, Catholic Twitter is just Twitter where a lot of Catholics are talking to each other.
Yeah, it's not a separate website.
It's not a
Twitter.
Real thing. It's kind of a made-up thing. But like any other online community, there's going to be good and bad. So there's, you know, infighting and people being ridiculous and petty and just weirdos and all kinds of stuff. But then there is really some good connection being made there, and you know, prayer requests, people having really good conversations, as good as you can have on social media. It's going to be limited. It's going to lack nuance, but good conversations about faith and about interesting things. And I think, like you said, just staying kind of connected with each other during COVID when we were all feeling really isolated, I think there were some good things to come out of that. But yeah, Catholic Twitter is a wild ride. I don't know if I would recommend that anyone hang out in Catholic Twitter. Is probably better things to do, but you know, there's some good things that come out of it too.
I'm not Catholic, but my knowledge of Catholicism and traditions has greatly increased because of that. And you know, with a lot of what's happening politically, you know, especially conversations about pro-life, pro-choice, there have been so many interesting takes on Catholic Twitter that I've found, whether it's, you know, individuals or their publishings on America Magazine or National Review, whatever it might be. It seems like there is maybe this is just my perspective, but a higher level of intellectualism within Catholic Twitter than I find in others. And I think it's because there's a lot of very well-revered authors and professors, you know, like Notre Dame is obviously one of the preeminent Catholic schools in the country. But the level of discourse that's happening on Twitter and Catholic Twitter especially, it's remarkable. Like the theological conversations that are taking place, and you can watch it thread by thread.
Yeah, I think part of that comes from just the intellectual tradition within Catholicism. You know, Catholics starting the university system in Europe, and there's this intellectual tradition there. And there's also, because of the way the church is structured and different documents that hold authoritative weight and different ways of communicating Catholic doctrine, there's a lot of opportunity to go back when there's a conversation about what's going on in popular culture or politics, to go back and say, well, let's talk about this looking at this papal document from the 1600s, because there's something going on there. And so it's kind of drawing on this intellectual tradition. And I think that that's a little bit of why you see that more there. But it's pretty fascinating.
You're hearing from Haley Stewart. She's a Catholic author, podcaster, and speaker. You're also a fellow of the Word on Fire Institute. What is that, and what's your involvement with that group?
Sure. So the Word on Fire Institute was started by Bishop Robert Barron, and it is the Institute is a, its goal is to help lay people be evangelizers in the culture. And so Institute members join the Institute. They have access to courses on both Catholic teaching, Catholic writers, Catholic tradition, but also how to really bring their faith into their relationships, into their work, and so how to evangelize in dialogue with the culture rather than kind of separated from the culture. So both understanding the culture, understanding literature, understanding all of these things so that we can really actually dialogue with people and actually have deep conversations and share our faith in a way that's going to make sense to people and share a common language of faith.
The Catholic Church is a little bit different from other Protestant denominations here in the States because for the Catholics, Christmas, quote unquote, is much more of a season. It's a longer thing. It's not just show up to church Christmas Eve, be there Christmas Day. There's Advent. There's Epiphany afterward. There's a Christian calendar that you guys abide by quite strictly that a lot of other denominations don't. Help our listeners understand what the Christmas season is like in the Catholic Church.
Sure. So I think in American popular culture, we think of Christmas as being kind of the Christmas season is kind of between Thanksgiving and Christmas Day. And then that's the end. You take your tree out to the curb. It's over. And in the liturgical year, so kind of the Christian calendar that Christians for the past several hundred years have kind of lived their life, that the liturgy follows, the beginning, the lead up to Christmas is Advent. So that's going to start 4 Sundays before Christmas. And it's this time, rather than a hustle, bustle, festive time, it's kind of this quiet preparatory time. So you're getting ready for Christmas. And then the party of Christmas starts on Christmas Day, goes for 12 days, really party hard for 12 days. And then on January 6th, which is Epiphany, when we celebrate when the wise men came, and it signifies that Christ is the light of the whole world for all people. So that's kind of the wrap up of those 12 days of Christmas, and that Epiphany season continues on after that. So it's a longer time both of preparation for Christmas, but then also of continued festivity, like really enjoying that time of the 12 days of Christmas, which is kind of opposite what we do as a culture. So it's difficult to live out because everybody is ready for Christmas way before Christmas. And I used to be more of a liturgical stickler. Now, I think as my kids get older, I've like loosened up and we'll do Christmas movies before Christmas and get our Christmas tree before and that sort of thing. But just kind of taking time to not be super busy, not be running yourself ragged, but to take some quiet time to get ready for Christmas, get your heart in the right place, get spiritually ready so that December 25th forward, you can just really kick up your heels and enjoy Christmas and be ready for it instead of be burned out and exhausted.
What are some of the things that your family and you do to stay mindful in the Advent season?
Yeah, one of the things we try to do is do simple meals, like do a lot of soups, easy meals, quiet time. I was thinking this year, because always my kids get sick during Advent. It's like the time of year where all children get sick. And I was telling my husband yesterday, next year I'm just not planning anything all of Advent because someone's going to be sick all the time. But mostly we just try to take a step back from all the stuff. There's so many things you can do, and we do some of the festive Christmas things, but just not packing the calendar. Just when there's options to put things into our schedule, just kind of taking a step back and saying, well, maybe we could just do a quiet family night. You know, maybe we can just relax, get ready, and just have a different attitude towards those December days before Christmas.
As I mentioned earlier, you are prolific in your publishing. You have a new book that's coming out in March, Jane Austen's Genius Guide to Life. Where did the impetus for this book come from? You just a big Britlit fan? Love Mr. Darcy?
Yes, all of the above. Jane Austen's one of my favorite writers, always has been. And I've had this idea brewing for years and years and years. And finally, actually made it happen this past year. So wrote the book this past year, and it'll come out in March. But it's basically looking at Jane Austen more as a moral philosopher who has ideas about how to live our lives and how to cultivate the virtues we need to become the people we're supposed to be. And so kind of looking more big picture of the ideas that she brings out in her novels and then how we can learn from that in modern life.
So what are some of those findings or learnings that we should take from Jane Austen?
Sure. Well, just to go with her most popular book, Pride and Prejudice is probably what people are most familiar with. And in that one, both of the main characters are learning humility. So they start out in, they both have pride issues, both Elizabeth Bennet, the protagonist, and Mr. Darcy, the love interest. They both have pride issues, and their pride kind of, it keeps them from seeing reality. It keeps them from seeing things as they really are. It has a blinding effect, which is true of any kind of sin. It kind of blinds us from what's real and what's true. And so over the course of the novel, they both are able to develop the humility they need to be able to see clearly, to actually have good relationships with other people, and continue to grow. And so by the end of the novel, we feel really positive about their trajectory, that they're going to have developed the humility they need to be able to move forward.
I think it's a really cool concept, taking Jane Austen's writings and distilling it to modern interpretations of life and creating a philosophy for her that maybe she hadn't listed out herself. And I've noticed that there seems to be an uptick in authors who are building out worlds that other authors had made before. So for instance, I was looking for Christmas gifts. I just found that there's a cookbook that's based on food from Harry Potter. And so obviously J.K. Rowling never put in a recipe for butterbeer, but this author, cookbook person, has taken what she thinks would have been the things that Harry Potter people read, and she's created a whole world around it and a whole cookbook around it. It's amazing that you're able to go in depth enough with Jane Austen and her work to craft a modern narrative of her philosophy.
Yeah, well, I actually have that cookbook, the Harry Potter cookbook.
Okay.
But what's interesting about Austen is I feel like I only scratched the surface of her moral philosophy. I think that really there's so much there. And she's really building on a tradition of moral philosophy that is passed down from Dante and Aristotle. You know, we don't know if she sat down and read Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, or, you know, we don't know exactly what she read growing up, but her family were scholars. You know, her dad ran a school, and she would have been exposed to some of those ideas of ethics and moral philosophy, whether she read Aristotle or not. And so it's really, it didn't take a lot of world building, because it's really all in there.
One of the things that I really like about the Catholic Church is the veneration of saints. And there seems to be much more of a focus on church history and Catholicism than there are in a lot of other religions. And I was reading your bio and noticed you have a daughter named Hildy. There's a lady named Hildegard van Bingen. I don't know if that's who you named her after, but this lady, Hildegard van Bingen, she was born 1098, died 1179, but she's considered by many in Europe to be the founder of scientific natural history. She was a polymath, she was an abbess and writer, composer, philosopher. There are probably people with similar credentials to hers in the Protestant sphere and in the Jewish sphere and in all these other religious traditions, but I don't feel like they get venerated in the way that the heroes of Catholicism do.
Yeah, the veneration of saints was something that I thought was really weird, especially growing up Protestant. I thought, like, wow, that's really weird. And now it's one of my favorite things about being Catholic, I think partly because the saints are all so different from each other. You know, you have St. Hildegard, who was a medieval abbess, who's a genius, who contributed to this amazing intellectual tradition. She was a musician. You can still listen to her music. I mean, just incredible woman. And then you've got Joan of Arc, who was a peasant girl who then becomes a military leader. You've got so many different kinds of people who are able to display the love of Christ and display holiness in a way that only that person could, because they've become the person God designed them to be. And you kind of see them living out that incredible awakeness, you know, this liveliness in completely different ways, depending on where they are in the world and what time in history and what their personality was like and what their gifts were and whether they were single or married or whether they had kids or whether they lived in a monastery. You know, all of those things show us the many ways of being holy and kind of help us imagine, could I be a saint? You know, could I be, in what way does God want me to be holy? Because it's not going to look quite the same as anyone else, but I can look to these people and be inspired by their stories and their lives and even ask them for help and ask them to pray for me.
It's not past history, it's present history. Correct me if I'm wrong, you know better, but I think I read an article about a young man who was named a saint within the last couple years because he had done something with computers, like created a computer database to tell people the gospel or something like that. But
yeah.
This is like a young man who passed away, but was venerated in death because of the modern work he was using.
Exactly. So that's Blessed Carlo Acutis. He was an Italian boy. He was really good at technology. He loved to play Pokemon. Like, you know, he would have been a millennial. You know, he was my generation. And he died of cancer, but he was just a really holy young man, loved Jesus, loved the Eucharist. He created early on in the age of the internet, he created websites about Eucharistic miracles and just showed, you know, what it looks like to be holy as a young teenager in the modern age. And so I saw a stained glass window of him the other day on the internet, and it was, you know, him wearing his Nikes and his tracksuit and, you know, just looking like a regular kid, which is very cool to see modern saints, seeing that it's not just for then, it's for now.
It's aspirational when you see people who look like you and think like you in positions of power, because you recognize that could be me too, right?
Absolutely.
I think about that a lot with like real estate development, where, you know, we want to include these communities of color, but if there's a bunch of gringos like me who are showing up and starting all the businesses, it does not empower the people of color in that neighborhood to feel like, oh, this business supports me or this business knows me. They need to see people like themselves, and it's incumbent on all of us to bring people into that fold.
And absolutely. And there's a bigger push right now that I think has been really needed to show more visual diversity of saints in churches, because there are amazing saints of color in the Catholic Church. And it's just really, it's important to go into your parish and see someone who looks like you to remember, I can be a saint too. And so having that variety and diversity, I think, is important.
Well, I'm glad we found your next book. Haley Stewart is a Catholic author, podcaster, speaker, and fellow of the Word on Fire Institute. Thank you so much for stopping by Downtown Depot.
Thanks so much for having me. This was a blast.
Thanks again to my guest, Haley Stewart, who can be found on Twitter at Haley Carrots. And thanks to you for tuning into episode 117 of Downtown Depot here on Waco's National Public Radio Station. I'll be back on the first Friday of 2022 with an inspirational look back and look ahead at the year. But be sure that you're following me on Facebook and Instagram at Waco Business News for updates in between episodes. I'm Austin Meek, and you've been listening to Downtown Depot, where we track the ins and outs of Waco business.